Pope Leo's first gathering of cardinals in Rome wrapped with one cardinal doubling down on restricting the traditional Latin mass, the papal posse. Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal join me with analysis. And Jimmy Lai's mitigation hearings are underway in Hong Kong while his health continues to worsen. Director of the Center for Religious Freedom, Nina Shea, is here with an update. Plus, author Carrie Gress shares her new book on the clash between Christianity and feminism the world over. Begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. As we celebrate our 30th year, we have an important show for you tonight. If you'd like to make a comment, you can find me on X. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Quick programming note, the world over is preempted next week, but we will return with a new show January 29th. The extraordinary consistory wrapped in Rome, and we're learning more about what happened behind closed doors. One cardinal lobbied to restrict the celebration of the traditional Latin mass, while others are calling for more synodality and less doctrine, whatever that means. Here with insight and analysis, the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer, priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Welcome, gents. Cardinal Arthur Roach, who's the prefect of the Vatican's liturgical office, distributed a letter to the cardinals at the end of this gathering, doubling down on Pope Francis's restrictions on the traditional Latin mass. He was almost lobbying for it. He wrote that the use of the old liturgical books, quote, was a concession that in no way provided for its promotion, end quote. Father, what does that mean? And why at a gathering of cardinals is Roche essentially allowed to browbeat the cardinals into embracing this Francis-era ban on the ancient rite of the Church, Father?
Well, that's a good question, Raymond. It's very troubling that Cardinal Roach would take this opportunity to essentially say that everything that Pope Benedict did in favor of the traditional Latin Mass, we have to forget about it. We have to, you know, put that, as it were, on the ash heap of history. And, you know, he says that it's a concession, but not a promotion, as if Pope Benedict just was helping a few old people and then eventually the Mass would go away. That's not at all what Pope Benedict was trying to do. He spoke about mutual enrichment of the two rites. So it's very troubling. The Latin Mass is a very popular thing. People know that. And what Pope Francis did has caused havoc and much disunity in the church. I don't think we need any more of that. In fact, what we need is a reconciliation where the Vatican says what Pope Benedict did was true pastoral charity.
Yeah, Bob, Roche went on, he went further, claiming those who celebrate the old mass, quote, do not recognize the validity of the council, end quote, the Second Vatican Council. That's quite an accusation against people who continue to fill the pews every week in many parishes around the world and are faithful to the Pope in Rome. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think he's misrepresenting the situation deeply. He's misrepresenting it in its practical terms. And he's misrepresenting it in a theological way as well. I mean, he talked about what the use of the old Latin Mass does is it freezes divisions. This is quite a difference from what Father was just talking about, where Pope Benedict talked about mutual enrichment, where the old rite and the new rite actually interact with one another. We know that there are parishes where the two are celebrated side by side, and there doesn't seem, generally speaking, to be much of a problem. And he also goes on and he says that this is an ecclesiological question. And he's right about that, because we're talking about the continuity of the church over time. It isn't as if Vatican II is this mega council that cancels everything that went before. And so I think that he's misrepresenting a number of the things here. He's also trying to identify the mass that came out of after Vatican II as coming out of Vatican II. And we're now going to have a series of catechesis about the documents of Vatican II by Pope Leo. It'll be very interesting to see when he gets to the document Sacramentum Concilium about the liturgy, what he's going to say, because clearly we've said this many times on the show. What the Vatican II document about the liturgy says is not the liturgy that we got afterward.
No, it doesn't look like a lot of liturgy, most of them that you encounter in parish worship. Father, I read some accounts of cardinals coming out of this consistory. And during their exchanges with the press, one of the cardinals, I can't remember the name, but from some far-flung part of the world, he said, the consistory allows us to get back to the roots, Vatican II. Is there danger of casting the roots of the church in the early 1960s?
Well, of course there is, because the roots of the church go back to Jesus Christ and the apostles. So, you know, if we get into this false notion that modernity represents a rejection of everything that came up to it, then we'll look at the Catholic version of modernity as Vatican II and what followed. And the Catholic vision is not that at all. You know, as Bob was saying, this has to be seen in the context of what Vatican II and the previous councils all said about the sacred liturgy.
Right.
And Bob's point is profound. It's legitimate to debate whether the new order of the Mass is an accurate reflection of what the Second Vatican Council fathers thought they were voting for. And I know there's a deceased now liturgist, Klaus Gomber, who wrote that the revisions in the 1965 version of the Roman Missal reflected precisely what the Council Fathers wanted, which was a mix of vernacular and Latin, but essentially keeping all of the prayers and forms of the of what we call now the TLM, the traditional Latin Mass. So, no, we have to look at the Church as a unity and a whole, doctrinally, historically, and experientially.
Yeah, well, one could argue the traditional Latin Mass today, with the involvement of the laity who are, you know, responding to the prayers and praying along, that is what the Church Fathers desired at the Second Vatican Council, and it certainly reflects and connects to the tradition before. Well, we're getting to that another time, but few cardinals were allowed to actually address the entire College of Cardinals. Cardinal Zen was allowed all of 3 minutes. He blasted synodality. We will spend a lot of time on this week's Prayerful Posse on the Arroyo Grande podcast. But, Bob, there was a report to the college by Cardinal Fabio Baggio, and he's the head of the Vatican's Human Development Office. He defended Pope Francis's reforms of Vatican governance, claiming they marked a, quote, healthy decentralization, which leaves to the competence of the bishops the faculty to resolve issues that they know well and that do not affect the unity of doctrine. Then he claims Francis's reforms aim to give the church the face of synodality and calls the dicasteries and offices of the Roman Curia, the Holy See, to be primarily centers of listening. Is that what the Holy See is, Bob?
Well, look, I mean, these are delicate questions, and I think we're going to have to wait to see how these things play themselves out. There clearly is a listening function in the church. It's listening to what other people are saying, but also listening to God. Let's say that that is the first voice that we should be listening to. But there's also the factor of the church being a spokesman, of being the voice of God, the mystical body that speaks about what God has revealed to us. And so whether we should tie this to Pope Francis, I mean, we have to admit candidly, look, we're in a new papacy. The last years of Francis were very divisive. There was a lot of tension in Rome. And we're all familiar with Rome, the three of us. And you would go over there and you would hear complaints from people. They didn't know what they were supposed to do. Things were ambivalent. You just had the sense of this brooding tension among people. And already, I think one of the positive signs is a great deal of that has disappeared under Leo. We'll see if that continues and what direction it's going to go in, naturally. Mm-hmm. But to talk about church governance, as long as we're having this conversation, yes, let's discuss what is the role, the Petrine ministry, as John Paul II called it. What is that role? What is the legitimate role of the bishops? It cannot be, in my estimation, and I think in all three of our estimations, what we see in the synodal way in Germany, where we are departing from doctrine. But there is a legitimate way in which bishops have governance over their own dioceses. But that has to be parsed out very, very carefully. We can't just lay down this idea that, oh, yeah, we've moved in that direction now and bishops have certain powers. No, I mean, this is what the future of the church is going to hinge on, whether we have a really dynamic working articulation of what these two sides are, the Pope on one side and the bishops on the other.
Father Baggio, Cardinal Baggio, goes on to say that the reforms of Francis allows the church to respond more adequately and effectively to the missionary challenges of the time. A renewed exercise, he said, of the aggiornamento initiated in the Second Vatican Council. Does it, in your estimation?
Well, the statistics don't hold that out because the church is dying in Europe and mass attendance in North America has declined precipitously since the close of the council. We have currently a vocations crisis in the United States that's unprecedented. The number of seminarians is extremely low. Religious life of teaching orders, for instance, we're down to a handful of sisters in the classroom. So I don't see that. And, you know, when Cardinal Baggio talks about, you know, the Vatican is sort of like a listening center, well, how about listening not just to the bishops, but to the laity? Because the laity, as regards, for instance, the Latin Mass, they have clearly said, we want Rome to stop crushing what we find sacred. That's got to be part of this deal. And the face of synodality, again, this is entering into a language that no one can give precise definitions to. We hear that synodality means walking together and listening. Well, for me, that's taking a walk after lunch in the park with my buddies. That's not the exercise of governance and teaching in the church. So synodality is basically covering every change that's been made under Pope Francis and say, well, guess what? That's synodality. I don't know what synodality is. That's why I'm very suspicious of it.
Yeah. No, it's very odd, though, that we're... Yes, Bob, to pick up on what you said, we are in a new pontificate, but in many ways, it feels like there's a lobby pushing to retain and extend the last pontificate. And I mean, whether by written form, these cardinals got multiple reports from holdovers from the Francis era, Roche and Cardinal Fernandez, who's head of the doctrinal office, and now Baggio, all sort of pounding, making the case for the Francis vision. They have to give way to what the cardinals want, what the church needs in this moment, and frankly, what Pope Leo sees for the future of the church. Bob, very quickly on that point.
We don't traffic in a great deal of optimism here in the posse, but I'm going to just say that I hear from other voices. And I read today that Cardinal Pizzaballa of Jerusalem is a very fine man. He's a very substantial man. He's in a difficult situation, and he's shown himself to be very good. He said, and I think that this is probably the general sense, that the meeting didn't produce any large conclusions. But it was a good start. It was a good chance for the cardinals to meet with one another. And I think that we shouldn't jump the gun on this. I mean, we're all nervous coming out of the trauma of Pope Francis, I think, about what is going to happen going forward. But I think we have to wait and see a little bit. It may go badly. It may surprise us. But at this point, I don't think we have a definitive sense yet.
Bob, with a note of optimism. I like it, Bob. Okay, we'll put a pin in that.
I'm a believer in the God of surprises, Raymond.
I'm just worried about some of those surprises may not be from God. But okay, I want to move on to Pope Leo's meeting with Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. She met with the Pope after winning the Nobel Peace Prize, having legitimately won Venezuela's presidential election before the Maduro regime stepped in and stole it from her through fraud. Pope Leo said the U.S. action against Venezuelan narco-terrorists and that entire state was, quote, violence never brings victory. The key is to seek dialogue, end quote. Father, your thoughts on this meeting with Machado, and should the church in the person of the Pope be calling for dialogue with a state like Venezuela?
Well, I think we need some realism here. The United States engaged in military-assisted law enforcement action because he was arrested in order to be brought to an arraignment, which happened in my city here in New York at the federal court in the Southern District. So this was not the kind of violence that Maduro inflicted on his people. There are 8 million people who have left Venezuela as refugees under Chavez and Maduro. The violence done to that country by that narco dictator and his predecessor is immeasurable. Now, I support peaceful means, but guess what? Trump tried. We know from the public record that Trump said to him, we'll let you go to a third country and you won't have to be prosecuted, and then you just got to hand over power to somebody legitimate. Maduro didn't want to do it. Maduro hired Cuban mercenaries to protect himself. So you can't deal with criminals, whether they be, you know, in the streets of a city or heading a nation, by saying, let's talk some more. Criminals always use whatever means they can to preserve themselves.
Yeah. Bob, your take on this and this idea we often hear about the church's heart for refugees, many of them Venezuelan refugees, and they're worried about the human dignity of those refugees. Well, isn't this a relief to the people in their suffering in that country?
Yeah, I mean, Father's right. One third of the population of Venezuela fled these two socialist communist regimes, Chavez and Maduro. I'm going to be a little bit of a stickler, and I want to think about this from Catholic social justice and Catholic social doctrine terms. Violence is always wrong. So when Leo talks about violence, he's correct. But the use of force, the just use of force, and I want to make a distinction between the idea of force and violence. When a policeman shoots somebody who's about to shoot an innocent person, he uses force. He's not using violence. And we need to maintain that distinction, or we're going to be confused about everything, because then everything is supposed to be, we sit down and we talk with people. And there are people, unfortunately, that you can't talk with, as Father rightly said. Mm. So I think that was a mistake. I think that they were much more careful in talking about what the ultimate goal of this should be, the well-being and the safety of the Venezuelan people. Now, that I think some people read that as an anti-Trump remark. I think you might give the Vatican a little bit of leeway here and say it was a diplomatic way of saying, okay, if you're going to move in and do this, the ultimate goal has to be what we all want, which is a peaceful, prosperous, functioning, free Venezuela. And if that is what the result is, and we don't know yet, there are conversations going on today, actually, over this. And I'm sure that the Pope got an earful from Maria Machado, because she knows where the bodies are buried, quite literally, in Venezuela.
Gentlemen, I want to get to the Pope's recent address to the Vatican Diplomatic Corps. It hit several themes. He warned about diminishing free speech in the West and the rise of what he called Orwellian language and a renewed zeal for war. He also lamented weak multilateralism in the international community, and he condemned the use of unilateral force by certain nations. Father, you liked, I know, the condemnation of the Orwellian speech codes.
Yes, I thought that was excellent. I think the Pope is addressing a very serious problem, which is particularly afflicting the English-speaking world and Northern Europe, which is the government using the so-called hate speech laws to suppress dissent from government policies. And it is Orwellian. You know, when people talk about free speech and then basically arrest people because and that's happening in England right now, where people, you tweet something and then suddenly you're being arrested. I thought that was good language. Now, of course, you know, this is where we have to say, well, truth be told, if words have meaning, then let's get the dictionary out and try to find the word synodality and you know, give us a clear meaning of it. Because otherwise, we're going to have church version of Orwellian speak. And sometimes I feel that way. You know, if you said, for instance, people often say, well, if you're not in agreement with the synodality, then you're not a good Catholic. And you say, well, wait a minute. Can't we find out what it means first before we tell people it's violating Catholic teaching if you object to what some people claim it is? So the Pope is right. Orwellian language has to go, politics and religion.
Yeah, Bob, on the other side, the Pope also called for peace and a dialogue in Iran, in Syria, while rumors are swirling of U.S. involvement. We're seeing Iran's regime near the breaking point. Is the Vatican's approach here realistic, dealing with these international hotspots? Can you dialogue with the mullahs in Iran or Syria?
Well, look, we've tried this in many instances. For years and years, we've tried one thing and another with a place like Iran, and it doesn't seem to get us much of anywhere. Look, I like the Pope's speech a great deal, too. And for the most part, I mean, he's talking to the diplomats accredited to the Holy See mission. I thought it was very genial. I thought it was, generally speaking, very good. I agree with Father that this question about definitions, I mean, we just had this absurd case in our U.S. Congress where a doctor was being interviewed and she couldn't tell whether men can have babies or not, you know, because this Orwellian language is, we don't know what a boy and a girl is. But look, on these particular cases, you can talk about multilateralism because that sounds nice. Like we're all going to cooperate and make things some things happen. But we know that if there is a problem in the Middle East, or if there is a problem in Africa, or if Haiti undergoes one of its terrible earthquakes or storms hit it, what is the only power on earth at this moment capable of responding to these circumstances? It's the United States. And I've debated this many times when I've been abroad. I understand why people get nervous about this, because they know that the Colossus of the North is going to come along and do what it wants. But if you look at in the Pope's speech, he talks about the UN, how lamentable it is that it's weak. And yes, it is lamentable, but it's weak. And three quarters of the member states of the UN are not exactly states that we want to hear the opinion of. They're tyrannies, they're kleptocracies, you know, they're just terrible places. And so what are we going to do in the meantime? In the meantime, I think we're moving toward a different international order to begin with. But as J.D. Vance said, we want a international order that includes a Europe that goes back to its founding values, which mostly means its Judeo-Christian values. A Europe that is based on that rather than the kind of, you know, woke pieties that it's been embracing over the last few years. That is a Europe we could deal with, and we could actually make some things happen in the world. I think the Vatican has to begin to recognize that.
Yeah, but Father, you wish the Vatican would say, we need more of what we're seeing here and here and here. I mean, you've got Maloney in Italy, right in his backyard. You've got Hungary. I mean, you have examples of this Christian ethos returning to those governments or trying to. Is it incumbent upon the Holy See to sort of fan the flames of that return to a Judeo-Christian and a refounding of the roots? Pope Benedict wrote extensively about this, particularly vis-a-vis Europe. Well,
yes, and this was, remember, the new evangelization that St. John Paul II started in Europe, I mean, and all the whole world, but it was primarily gauged to Europe because he, as a European, was concerned with the loss of faith. Yeah, the Holy See, obviously, the main mission of the Holy See is to promote the Catholic faith, and that's what the Pope does, and we bless him, and he's doing the things that popes need to do. But we want him, in addition, to do some of the stuff that has proven successful under Popes Benedict and John Paul II to reanimate that faith. And that's why the call to clarity and truthfulness, you know, reminded me of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. That was issued by John Paul II to answer doctrinal uncertainties. It's a marvelous document. It's done so much good in the life of the Church. So, yeah, but to basically say the left-wing European political wokeism, not a big problem, and let them do what they want. I don't think the Pope believes that, but I think there are others who do, and that's got to stop. We cannot endorse the suppression of the history of Christianity, the Judeo-Christian tradition, as Bob says, in Western Europe. That has to be supported.
Yeah. Very quickly, Pope Leo is planning a trip to Spain and to the Canary Islands, where immigration will very likely be on the agenda given the migration crisis there. Bob, your thoughts on the trip, given the reality we just discussed on the ground in Europe?
Yeah, I've said this before, but I'm not going to back off on saying this. I think that the Vatican is still captive to a model about immigration that no longer works in the world that we're finding ourselves in. Look, the United States is a big country. We like to talk about ourselves as a country of immigrants. We do very well at integrating people here. We admit over 1 million people a year, and we're trying to boost that a little bit because we can probably take a bit more. But the kind of inundation that is taking place in Europe by Muslims primarily, and in the UK in particular, and in France. And you mentioned, Raymond, the way that countries like Hungary and Poland and Slovakia and Czechia have got to restrict immigration because of the way that it destroys and disrupts the fabric of their societies. I don't think the Vatican has taken a measure of this. Leo keeps talking about using Islam as an excuse to be anti-immigrant. And I say again, I think this is exactly backward. If there were productive, peaceful immigrants coming in who were easily integrated, who were not committing crimes, who were getting jobs and working. Who in his right mind would object to this, especially in those countries where populations are declining? So, look, again, I think that the Vatican is still a few years behind where the reality is right now. I don't expect that we'll see Leo change his tune when he's in Spain. But I think it's time for him to look carefully and hear from other people than the Vatican has been hearing from in the past.
Well, the danger, the danger there, Bob, becomes you alienate people who are suffering under this unrestricted immigration and the transformation of these European cultures. I mean, I know some of these people in Spain and in Italy even who feel that their culture is slipping from them, their future is slipping from them. Why alienate souls who need redemption and need the teaching and truth of the church over policy that is best left to the people in charge and the elected officials? Anyway, Father, the Pope also made strong statements on life, the life issues, particularly this week calling abortion deplorable. And then he called out surrogacy, which we rarely hear about anywhere in the culture. You know, but he said surrogacy distorts the family. Is this the clear moral voice of the church that is needed in this moment?
Absolutely. And I praise the Pope for doing that. We need to hear more of this. Morality is people who are immoral don't want to hear about morality. People who are trying to follow the moral law, they want encouragement and strength. And that's the Pope's job. John Paul II was famous on, you know, his foreign trips. He would bring up topics such as abortion and contraception that some people didn't want to hear about, but they need to hear about it. You know, morality is treated in the modern world as a choice, whereas in the Catholic faith, morality is an imposition by God of the just law to live a good life. People don't like to impose on me. The Ten Commandments are not a suggestion. They come from God. God says, do this, don't do that. So, yeah, I'm pleased when the Pope echoes the moral law because we need it. We need to be encouraged to follow it.
Excellent, gentlemen. We will leave it there. And be sure to check out this week's Prayerful Posse on the Arroyo Grande podcast, where we will get really in depth on this clash of cardinals over the future of the church at the consistory and much more. Robert Royal, Father Gerald Murray, thank you both. See you soon, Posse. This week in Hong Kong, Catholic media tycoon and pro-democracy activist Jimmy Lai's mitigation hearings have wrapped. Essentially, this is Jimmy Lai's last chance before sentencing in a trial that could see him spend the rest of his life in prison. Is there hope of leniency and release? Here to discuss all of this, director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute, Nina Shea. Nina, thank you for being here. We've followed, of course, Jimmy's case closely for years. This week, the Hong Kong High Court is hearing this mitigation plea, which is essentially his lawyer's last chance to try to get him out of an extended sentencing here, a long incarceration. What's actually happening in the courtroom or happened there? I know there were 4 days of hearings, but what are his chances under this national security law at this point?
Well, Raymond, I'm glad you're focusing on this again. It is his last chance. They are focusing, the defense, Lai's lawyers, focused on his health and the deterioration of his health and the fact that he's 78 years old. He has many problems, of heart problems and blood pressure problems, diabetes, that he developed actually in prison over the last 5 years, mm-hmm. solitary confinement. So he's already, in a sense, served 5 years. He's been 5 continuous years in solitary confinement in a maximum security prison in Hong Kong. He only has visits, I think, 1 hour, 2 hours a month by his family members. He doesn't see any other person. There's no one else in the cell block. So under these, and he doesn't see daylight directly.
Wow.
So he has no contact with nature or people. So that must be very taxing on anyone. And so they're arguing that because he served 5 years, because he's done this, because he's in this health situation, and because he actually didn't, you know, do any violence. I mean, he lit a candle in a vigil. That's one thing he did. That they charged him with and convicted him for, and also meeting with international figures. As a journalist, as a media tycoon, of course he's meeting with international figures. That's what they do. So they're making these arguments. And to answer your question, no, I don't have any expectation of leniency. I think that the only way that he can avoid spending the rest of his life, however long it is, and not dying in prison is if there is some kind of deal made with either our government or the UK government, like a trade, like a prisoner trade, for example.
Well, you have extensively covered over many years Jimmy's declining health. The family claims his teeth are rotting, his nails are falling off. Mm-hmm. President Trump's asked Xi Jinping to release him on humanitarian grounds. I know 5 UN experts made the same plea. The prosecutors in the case, in other words, the Chinese prosecutors against Jimmy, they say his health is unremarkable. That's the quote. Is this regime, is there any possibility that you foresee, given the direction of this? I mean, there were diplomats sitting at the hearing. Isn't public pressure, Nina, perhaps, the best way to get leniency or release in Jimmy Lai's case?
Well, definitely public pressure, and to show that he is considered a hero, a kind of martyr witness, that he stood for his principles and is a harmless person. He was treated like a cartel director by these, drug cartel head, capo. By these Chinese officials. They had him in shackles, I think it was 10 pounds of chains, while he was being transported back and forth to the jail and to the court. And snipers on roofs, and as if he was going to be kidnapped, taken by SEAL Team 6 or, SEAL Team 6. They put on this big performance art that he's a dangerous criminal. So the more the West stands up for him, because I say the West because the Chinese people themselves cannot say anything. Cardinal Zen, as you know, was in Rome last week, and he spoke about other things concerning the church, but he did not speak publicly about China. And that's because he's under the gun as well. He has a national security law investigation on his head. So no one in China, not 1.4 billion people, there's not one who can speak out on his behalf except his lawyers. And so it's really incumbent on us to speak up about him. Maybe the Chinese would not want a martyr. Maybe they would not want to make a hero. His is the only name we know, that anyone really knows in America of a political prisoner in China. How many others can you mention?
There are many others. I mean, you've documented some of them. This isn't happening in isolation, and it's a pity, it's a tragedy that the Catholic Church, the Vatican, and the church at large don't give more voice to these martyrs. And they're living martyrs or dead martyrs in some cases. But there are 7 Roman Catholic bishops whom you've detailed over the years are indefinitely without trial in China. They're just being held. You mentioned Cardinal Zen. It was a miracle they allowed him to attend the consistory, Nina. But again, he couldn't talk about anything related to China. What does Jimmy Lai's conviction tell us about the state of religious freedom, press freedoms, and basic human rights in this Chinese communist rule?
Well, that's exactly right. He's the personification of all the repression and injustice going on in China today. It's good that his name has been elevated because it's becoming more of a household name. There's more name recognition there in the West. And we need to know that there are legions of political prisoners in China's jails. They are tortured, they're raped, they're treated cruelly, that they're in these horrible conditions that deteriorate, where their health deteriorates. And some are killed. Some are killed for their organs. And we avert our eyes from that. We deny it. There's been a lot of denials of it. But we must recognize, without a doubt, that is what is happening to religious prisoners in China today, whether it's Falun Gong, whether it's the Uyghurs, even Christians. Are having their organs removed forcibly and harvested. And there are 2 books coming out on this. I hope it becomes better known. I don't think it's going to happen to Jimmy Lai. They like to take young prisoners But I did talk to a Christian, Raymond, who was a prisoner in China, and he had a complete blood workup and tissue typing consistent with organ harvesting while he was in prison before he was able to get out. So there are atrocities that are beyond belief going on in China today and in Hong Kong, and Jimmy Lai stands for that. I mean, his case stands for that, and he reminds us all that it's going on.
Yeah, I had to laugh out loud, Nina. This article appeared from CGTN. That's the official Chinese media organ of the Chinese government. They have an article that reads, "Inside Jimmy Lai's sentence hearing, what he sowed, he now reaps." The propaganda of this group and the outrageous thing is the collaboration of people in the West with what is a regime mouthpiece. You know, there's collaborators in Europe, there are collaborators in the United States. They are enabling death and the prosecution and persecution of the faithful and the freedoms of good people who are just trying to live their lives in their faith. So we're going to keep our eye on this Jimmy Lai case, but it's just it enrages me every time I see it. But just before Christmas, another case that you just weep every time you read one of these stories. I know you do, Nina. At least 20 Christians were killed in coordinated attacks in two Nigerian states. And this was after a missionary based in Iowa warned Nigerian authorities that these attacks were coming. The authorities dismissed the warning. President Trump, as you know, designated Nigeria as a country of particular concern for religious freedom violations. We talked about that before in 2025. And he recently launched airstrikes against the Islamic State forces there. What is actually happening on the ground now, Nina? And why does this Nigerian government seem either unable or, more likely, unwilling to stop these attacks?
Yeah, well, on the ground, it's the same pattern is continuing, Raymond, unfortunately. It's really a horrifying. Last Saturday night, 10 more Christians were murdered under the same pattern. They're farmers. They're in rural areas. This was in Taraba State, in the Middle Belt again. Fulani militias, jihadis coming in and slaughtering them. They're absolutely defenseless. And, you know, 20 churches have burned since Christmas as well. Kidnappings. There's still, you know, something like 15 prisoners, hostages being imprisoned by these jihadi groups, Christians since December. So it's going on. The other thing that's going on, though, since President Trump declared it a country of particular concern for religious persecution the end of October, the government has acknowledged that Christians are being persecuted. The government of Nigeria, that is. And that's important first step, but it's a very first step. Others in Nigerians themselves, Christian leaders, are starting to talk about it. And I asked them, I'm hearing from them, and I asked them, like, why now? Why didn't you talk about it before? It's been going on for years. And they said, well, in this culture of impunity, where the government doesn't take any action, there's no point to it. It could only risk our own lives. So they're risking their own lives now, hoping that the culture of impunity has ended, that the government will take action. But so far, I'm sorry to say, there hasn't been any meaningful action.
Well, we will keep our eyes on it. Nina, I thank you for continuing to watch this. You can find Nina Shea's reporting on persecution of Christians worldwide at Hudson.org. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you, Raymond.
Over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with actor, singer, director Robert Davi for a wide-ranging conversation. We talked about Hollywood, his music, faith, from Die Hard to The Goonies to License to Kill. And Davi reflects on his iconic roles as well as the craft of acting and the cultural forces reshaping film and awards culture. And did you know he encountered what he calls a miraculous healing through the intercession of Padre Pio? You sang really up until in your early life. You won music competitions in New York up until at 15. And then what happened?
Right after football season, I got very ill. They thought it was pleurisy. So the doctor was giving me antibiotics. I was home. It was right during the holidays. And I stayed sick through the time, and I wasn't getting better. And I was home. homing from like 235 pounds to 190, wow. Then 170. And my uncle comes over, he says, Mary, my mother's maiden name was Mary, you got to take him to the hospital, something's wrong. Of course, we did go to the emergency room and they admitted me and they tried to find out what was wrong. Now, at that time, there was a man named Joey Lamangino.
Oh.
Blind.
Yeah.
Tire blew up in his face when he was younger.
Yep.
The olfactory nerves were cut, his optic nerves were cut.
Mm-hmm.
And he would go to San Giovanni Rotonda in Foggia, Italy, to go to confession with Padre Pio. Oh. So Joey, I told my mom, can he pray for me? I'm in the hospital. They don't know what I have, and I'm...
How old are you now? 16, 17?
15, 16,
oh, wow.
Around that age.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, a telegram, pray blessings, I'm no doctor, from Padre Pio, because they didn't know what I had. And a pair of rosary beads blessed by him. I prayed on them. My mother dreamt of his mass, Padre Pio's mass. And a week later, Saturday morning, I'm sitting up in bed for the first time, and the doctor, Eugene Teich in Huntington Hospital, Long Island, says to my mother, Mary, if you told me your son would be in this shape a week ago, I'd say only a miracle. And this was, he had no idea about Padre Pio.
Wow.
He had no idea about the intercession.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Robert Davi is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. Subscribe so you don't miss an episode of the show. And it's free. And of course, be on the lookout Friday for our installment of the Prayerful Posse. We talk about Cardinal Zen throwing the gauntlet down at this consistory of cardinals in Rome. Go to Arroyo Grande Show wherever you get your podcasts. My next guest is sounding the alarm over feminism. She's a scholar at the Institute for Human Ecology at Catholic University of America. She's also author of a new book, Something Wicked, Why Feminism Can't Be Fused with Christianity. Dr. Carrie Grass, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
The title of your book, Something Wicked, I mean, I of course, the Shakespearean in me jumps out, the Macbeth reference, you know, by the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way came right to mind. But it also brings to mind Broadway and Hollywood's recent musicals, Wicked and Wicked for Good. The show, of course, is based on the Wizard of Oz book by L. Frank Baum. What's the connection there between feminism and Baum, who was the originator of the Wizard of Oz? Tell me about how that and how these hugely popular Wicked films continue to either embrace or defile that legacy.
No, I think it's a fascinating connection that very few people know. And I didn't know it either. I discovered it when I was researching the book. Frank Baum's mother-in-law was one of the first wave feminists. She was very close with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. They worked really closely together until... the feminists decided to join forces with the temperance movement, and Gage went nuts. She said, "We're supposed to be against Christianity. I'm involved in witchcraft. I'm not going to have anything else to do with you." So she also starts influencing her son-in-law and her daughter, introducing them to seances and all kinds of different variations of witchcraft. Well, this is who her son-in-law was Baum. And so you can see after her death, actually, he has this inspiration for the book, The Wicked Wizard of Oz. And in that book, you can see her influence, where you've got the good witch, you've got the bad witch, and you also have this character of the wizard who's supposed to represent the patriarchy, this idea that she's trying to dispel. So it's very much an anti-patriarchal feminist story shot through with all of this occult.
The recreations, the Stephen Schwartz musical and the films that followed, they're actually true to I have to tell you, I've always loved L. Frank Baum. I only recently came across this too, the connection to the suffragette movement and the kind of feminist undertones. I missed all of that the first read.
No, and I think most of us have. And that's what's really fascinating is just the longevity that it's had and the interest that it's held. And just it's very subtle and very subversive, I think. It's great storytelling, but it's conveying a lot more that's going on at the same time. But I think this is one of the important pieces that we've missed, too, is we tend to think of the first wave as something that was really good, when in fact it was really full of women who were either involved in witchcraft Or they were Unitarians, which means they didn't believe in Jesus. They thought male, any kind of male intermediary was going to be an obstacle to their faith with God because they were Unitarians. So Jesus is an obstacle. Mm. Pastors are an obstacle. Any kind of man is an obstacle. So that's really an important. And then finally, of course, we know that the bishop spoke out about it. Cardinal Gibbons wrote against these women as well. In 1902.
You argue in the book that feminism really, it isn't just misguided. It's actually a rival faith. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So I discovered this when I was trying to come up with really a concrete definition of what feminism is. And I started packing together all of these pieces that you see throughout the movement, either starting in the 1800s and kind of being recycled throughout the centuries. And so feminism, I noticed it, you know, it's got this idol, which is female autonomy. And then it has commandments. There are three things that all feminist women must do. They must be contemptuous of men, they must be promiscuous, and they must be involved in the occult. And those ideas came about from the 1800s. So it's fascinating to look at women today and see that women are involved in all three. There's also theological virtues, or I guess in this case, vices. Instead of faith, hope, and love, there is bitterness, envy, and contempt, or rage. Those are very clearly part of the doctrine of feminism, and intentionally so, because the early leaders of feminism realized that women are much more politically active if they're angry. So you can see a lot of that, I think, in our news cycle today. And then we have, of course, the sacrament, you know, which Peter Kreeft has been talking about for a long time, of abortion.
Yeah.
And Christ offered his body for us. A child is asked to offer its body for its mother. You know, this is your body offered for me. And then, of course, it has its own kind of evangelization, where feminist women who are broken break other people. And the cycle just continues of people that are trying to become autonomous and healthy are really kind of running into a wall, because this is, of course, not really how you get to true and authentic human flourishing.
Well, in the book, you compare feminism to communism, suggesting it's even more dangerous. As you put it, people don't have their guard up against it in the same way. Now, we're seeing this play out right now. Yesterday at the Supreme Court, they heard arguments in these two landmark cases about transgender athletes in women's sports. Justice Kavanaugh noted the harm that girls who don't make the teams because you've got biological males competing with them. How does this connect to your argument about feminism as a false church, if you will?
Well, I think what it's trying to do is create this sense of people as unsexed, as disconnected with biology, home, maternity. It's trying to get people to be almost like ideal communist workers. So you know, our body parts don't matter, our fertility doesn't matter, and I think we can see this throughout the ages. And it culminates, of course, in the trans movement, because that's when you're really beginning to just remove body parts to actually get to this place where people are sterile and really neutered, you know, for lack of a better term.
But I'm struck, Carrie. Where are the feminist voices, though, if you'll excuse me, in this debate? You've got girls, you've got young women who are being pushed aside by guys who claim to be women.
Yeah. Well, this is the whole point, is it's never really been about helping women. This is not the goal of feminism. The goal is to promote this radical ideology that early in the 1900s got, you know, wed itself to communism. And this is the goal. It's the destruction of faith and family. And there's no better way to do that than to destroy a woman's body and her fertility. And we're seeing this, you know, if you can destroy a woman emotionally, allow her, you know, she becomes unhinged, all of these other pieces are going to fall into place. So this is why, you know, feminism really is, it's not something that's supposed to be just pro-woman. It's in fact really a very diabolical system that women have bought into, you know, largely unwittingly, but it's very pervasive.
Yeah, well, we've had Supreme Court justices who couldn't define what a woman was during their confirmation hearing. And just yesterday, we saw full confusion on display in the Senate. They had a hearing about the abortion pills being mailed all over the country. This is Dr. Nisha Verma. She's an OBGYN. She was called as an expert witness by the Democrats on the committee. She refused to answer when Senator Josh Hawley and Ashley Moody asked if biological men can get pregnant. Watch this.
Do you think that men can get pregnant?
I hesitated there because I wasn't sure where the conversation was going or what the goal was. I mean, I do take care of patients with different identities. I take care of many women. I take care of people with different identities. And so that's where I paused. I think, I wasn't sure where you were going with that.
Well, the goal is just the truth. So can men get pregnant?
Again, the reason I paused there is I'm not really sure what the goal of the question is.
The goal is just to establish a biological reality. You just said a moment ago that science and evidence should control, not politics. Absolutely. So let's just test that proposition. Can men get pregnant?
I take care of people with many identities, but
can men get pregnant?
Many women that can get pregnant. I do take care of people that don't identify as women.
Your take on this? I mean, when a medical doctor won't state basic biological reality, Carrie, what does that tell us?
It tells us that we're not really dealing with the realm of truth anymore. And this is why it's become this shadow religion, because it has captured people so intensely that they can't state the obvious anymore, because it's going to disrupt this sort of fragile in an ideological world that they've created. So yeah, no, it's remarkable to watch that kind of video and see how much she dodges the question, and you know, she never comes up with something that's remotely accurate or truthful.
No. Anyway, many Christian women, and I would venture to say a lot of Catholic women, consider themselves feminists in some sense. They believe in equal opportunity, equal dignity. What do you say to the women watching right now who think, look, I can be a faithful Christian and I can be a feminist? Is that a problem?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it is a problem. I think part of it is people use the word differently than what the movement actually is. So people are kind of massaging it and think that they can change the meaning of it, or they just think feminism is just about helping women. And so you really see that the problems arise, though, because feminism isn't just about helping women. It's really about promoting an ideology that is intent on breaking down the family and the faith. And that's why it's so dangerous, because of the fact that it's uniquely positioned itself to look like it's just there to help women. And women have bought into this for a very, very long time. And so that's the hard part, is getting women to see, no, actually, there's a lot more going on here than you even realize.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the Catholic women throughout history, Queen Isabella and St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, great abbesses who wielded enormous influence without feminism. I mean, they had their own, the divine gifts that God gives women. They certainly displayed. I think of my own mother, Angelica. In fact, you argue they had more authentic power and purpose. What's your response to those who say without feminism, women would still be oppressed?
Yeah, I think feminism it is really about power and it's about control. And this is what Catholics understand deeply, is that your greatest power is going to be the surrender that you have to Christ and to the head. He's the head of the hierarchy, the patriarchy. He's the one to whom we get any power or control. And that's really where when we are living in him, that's really where we can change the world and the culture. And we've really turned it around with this idea of, you know, misplaced compassion that we have in the world, where we think, I'm going to go change the world, but it's going to be people I never meet or halfway around the world. You know, it's sort of epitomized in the woman who works for PETA, but she's aborting her own child. It's kind of that idea that we don't want to be, you know, involved in the messy embodiedness of life, but we want to do something grand and big and life, you know, world changing, but not really realizing that God is going to entrust you with very small local things first. And when you prove yourself in that ground, then you can do the big things. And I think this is what we see with the abbesses and all the saints and, you know, this incredible work that we have on women. Mm-hmm. And I think too, that, you know, John Paul II offered us a fantastic blueprint about understanding women and how we could move forward and, you know, promoting women. And that the problem is that it's really been corrupted by this the first wave, by trying to include the first wave in it and make it seem like those were sort of continuous, you know, on the same continuum, when in fact they were really very, very different. And John Paul saw the problems with feminism and really tried to navigate around them. So I think we at one point had an opportunity to have something like a Catholic feminism, but because we weren't particularly disciplined and really focusing on what John Paul was saying, we, you know, kind of got off course by trying to include the early feminists who were clearly anti-Christian.
Picking up on that notion of John Paul II's, you know, vision, that beautiful works he wrote so much on, the glory of women, the blessing of women, the compatibility of men and women, but the divine gifts that women have. In our church today, we have this synodality idea, and you see these ongoing discussions about the ordination of women as deacons. Carrie, this seems a perfect example of trying to fuse feminism and Catholicism, is it not?
No, I think you're exactly right. And this has been, you know, kind of the cry since the beginning, you know, for decades, really, of, you know, women need more leadership roles. And that's, again, the kind of mistaken understanding of what real Christian women look like, that it doesn't have to be this, you know, place of power and control. And it has to be where God calls us to be and through the gifts that we actually have. I think the other key piece of this, too, is just the role that women as victims plays, I think, within the church, kind of this. We have to keep revisiting this because we haven't apologized enough to women or whatnot, but I'm still waiting for men to be apologized. You know, if certainly men have mistreated women, but women have mistreated men as well. And I think we need to look at both directions and really do a course correction in terms of understanding how it is that we help men be better men. And that's really what feminism has been trying to elicit from men, but just going about it in the exact wrong way for 200 years now. The same complaints that Mary Wollstonecraft are the same complaints women have today. So it's not about power and control. It truly is really about returning back to the faith and understanding the value of the church and what it is that it can offer each individual.
And the complementarity between the sexes, how men need women and women need men, and you only grow as a people, as families, as a culture, and as a faith if that complementarity happens in the family. And when it ruptures, nothing good comes of it. Something wicked this way comes. And the book is called Something Wicked: Why Feminism Can't Be Fused with Christianity by Dr. Carrie Gress. It's available January 20th at bookstores everywhere and online. Visit her website, theologyofhome.com. Carrie, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That is all the time we have for now, but be sure to catch us week after next. We're preempted next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.